Welcome to This Is Money Podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is a very special guest. That is all I'm going to say. Coming up, house prices. Are they really set to fall by a fifth? Bad banks, bungling energy suppliers, hapless phone firms. Now's the time for you to vote in Moneymail's annual Wooden Spoon Awards for terrible customer service. We take a look at the small building societies offering the best savings deals, but can you get one? And classic cars tipped to soar in value. But a Citroen BX? Really? I think that means something to some people. Simon will explain all. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at etoro.com/academy/podcasts.
But first, annual house price growth slowed dramatically in November to just 4.7%, down from 8.2% the previous month. That's according to Halifax's latest index. Month-to-month prices also fell by 2.3%, knocking almost £7,000 off the cost of an average house. The only region to buck that trend is the Northeast. But it isn't expected to stop there. The founder of Rightmove has been telling This Is Money. He reckons a house market slump is on the way, where prices could fall by as much as a fifth. Simon, welcome. What is going on?
The latest house price figures, which of course, Georgie, don't exactly match a bugbear of yours for many years.
Yes.
Why are there so many house price reports? Yes. Why don't they all say the same
exactly
thing? What on earth is going on here? Well, the latest ones, the most up-to-date ones, come from three different sources. So you've got the two big mortgage lender house price indices from Halifax and Nationwide, both of whom are gigantic mortgage lenders. Okay, they are pretty much the two biggest in the country. And they base it on their own mortgage approval data, their own mortgage data, right? And then you've also got Rightmove, which is based on asking prices, but it's based on the asking prices of newly listed properties. The first one that comes out is Rightmove. But you've got to remember that's only based on what people think they might be able to get for their property. But it's a really good sentiment one. Rightmove is showing that the pandemic boom is tailing off. You've then got Halifax and Nationwide. Figures don't match exactly, but the direction of travel does. Both of those indicate a sharp decline in the property market. That peak has been hit and we are now coming down. And what you have to remember is that both of those indices also reflect not just what buyers are doing and what buyers want to do, but also what Nationwide and Halifax want to do. Because if Nationwide and Halifax become more cautious on their mortgage lending, that's going to mean that they're going to lend less money to people. And the people that are using their mortgages are not going to be able to pay as much for houses. And therefore, you're going to start to see the average house price come down there. So on both of those indices, we had been seeing double digit inflation. We're now back down to about kind of 5% annual inflation. And I would expect that to continue falling. And on Nationwide's, the average house price dropped by about £4,500. On Halifax, it dropped by about £6,000. But, you know, there's no such thing as the average house. We always talk about this.
Indeed.
But it is a measure. It's a measure of what is happening. And there is enough data that goes through both the Halifax and the Nationwide reports for them to be an accurate portrayal of what is going on in the housing market. You've then also got the Land Registry / ONS house price report. That's based on prices paid. So the actual price that people are paying for properties, but there's a lag on that one. Doesn't come in for a couple of months after the month that it's talking about. So for example, it's December now. The most recent one would be an October one or something like that. But the picture is that the pandemic property boom is over.
Yeah.
I think. Now, yeah. I called time on the pandemic property boom a number of times and I was completely wrong. Okay. A number of times I said, I think that's it. We're done. We've had the sugar rush. We're done. And it just kept going. But the really big difference here is mortgage rates.
We're going to that in a sec, but I mean, my somewhat unscientific anecdotal evidence of of this market being personal experience and having gone round and taken a look at both rentals and properties to buy, the last one I went to look round had been reduced in the last month and a half by 25,000. I'll be honest with you, it was still massively, massively overpriced. So is this just the fact that, and you talk about the sugar rush, I wonder if a lot of people were trying to get in there quick before this inevitable slump in the market. And I saw the same, the reason I got thrown out of my last flat, which was enormously expensive, because the landlord wanted to raise it by even more money. And then he waited a couple of months, no one was renting it, and now it's back down to just above where what I was paying. So still high, but I'm just wondering if it's just that sugar rush that you talk about, or is it the annual figures that are just telling the much bigger picture, and the mortgage rates, which is what you're about to talk about?
Well, you've got to put this in perspective, and the perspective is that house prices have gone up about 25% since April 2020. So since the start of the pandemic, we've seen about 25% added to the average house price. Some areas, some houses gone up by more, some it's gone up by less. So what you also need to consider is at the point where we hit April 2020 and we got the most surprising property boom ever, the one that arrived when everyone thought, well, that's it. This has finally hit runaway house prices and in the UK on the head, lockdown, property market freeze, all that kind of stuff. And instead, prices went in the opposite direction. At that point, before this started, properties were already very expensive compared to wages. And really, the only thing that you can measure properties against, as far as I'm concerned, is wages, because it's wages that most people use to buy those properties. There are people who don't rely on their wages to buy properties. There are cash buyers out there. But the majority of home buyers, the people who make up the chunk of the market that really matters, go out, earn money, use that money to pay their mortgage. And if you get house prices that are very, very high above wages, people can continue to stretch for as long as banks and building societies are willing to lend them more money. The only thing that keeps that afloat is the willingness of banks and building societies to lend more money. And the thing that enables that is interest rates being low. After the start of the pandemic, we saw interest rates slashed down to a new record low of 0.1%. We saw mortgage rates come down from a level that they were already incredibly low. We had people fixing for 5 years at 1% or just above 1%. That game has totally changed now. Interest rates are on the way up. We've managed to go from 0.1% last December on the base rate to 3% now. There's a Bank of England base rate meeting on the 15th, which is a week's time. Interest rates are likely to go up again. Mortgage rates rocketed in the wake of the ill-fated mini budget of Kwasi Kwarteng. They have come down slightly now, but you are looking at a best 2 to 5 year fix of around 4.5%, whereas a year ago you were maybe looking at about 2%. And the difference there is that if you want to borrow £200,000 over 25 years on a repayment mortgage at 2%, your monthly payment will be £850. At 4.5%, your monthly payment will be £1,110. Okay, there's quite a big difference between those two numbers. We're talking about kind of £260 there, right? And if you then flip that around and work on the basis that people a year ago who had £850 that could go on a mortgage have probably only now got £850 that can go on a mortgage because their earnings are unlikely to have gone up substantially, but their bills have definitely gone up because they've got their energy bills that have gone up, they've got their food bills that have gone up. You know, energy bills are twice as expensive as they were this time last year, even with the energy price guarantee in place. Food inflation is 16%. Everything else has gone up. Basically, if you've got £850 a month, a year ago you could borrow £200,000. Now you can borrow £155,000. So unless you've got 45 grand knocking around down the back of the sofa, which is unlikely for most people who are buying a home, who often in many cases stretch themselves as far as they possibly can anyway, then you can afford to pay £45,000 less for that property. you might be able to find a bit of money to narrow the gap, but you're not going to be able to find all of it. Not most people anyway. And ultimately, that is going to mean that people can pay less for houses, sellers are going to have to accept less, and house prices are going to come down.
Will the bank of mum and dad not step up for first-time buyers particularly?
Well, the bank of mum and dad could step up, but I don't think the bank of mum and dad's feeling that flush either at the moment. And also the bank of mum and dad has already handed over a huge amount of money. Mm-hmm. And I think that arguably we had reached the position where the bank of mum and dad was handing over as much as it possibly could, as was the bank of gran and granddad. And in order to just get us to those very, very high house prices. I mean, they were already having to hand over a lot more before house prices came off the boil than they were in April 2020. And April 2020 wasn't that long ago, right? So I don't think that they've got any more money to give. And I think that this is the point where something has to give in terms of house prices. But this isn't necessarily a bad thing, because arguably, even if you're selling, chances are you might be moving to another property, right? So you're buying another property and you might sell for less, but then you buy for less. Mm-hmm. And that continues all the way along the chain. And we would be in a much better position. I've argued this for many years. If house prices were much lower in this country, people borrowed much less compared to their wages. It wasn't a casino moving home. It was just my salary's gone up. I need another bedroom. I can borrow a bit more money. I can buy another house, rather than this colossal gamble that it involves borrowing huge sums of money, begging as much as you can of family, wondering if prices are going to go up or prices are going to go down. And the casino has been enabled for the last, 10 and a bit years since the financial crisis, since we saw the prices start to pick up after the financial crisis a decade ago, by super low mortgage rates. And a scenario where we get back to mortgage rates at more manageable and normal levels, and let's face it, 4.5% is still historically cheap, but house prices at a lower level, is a much better scenario for most people. The only people who lose out are the people at the very, very top of the ladder who are selling up and they're not buying somewhere else. Now, for many of those people, sadly, they will be dead. So they won't actually be selling up themselves, because, there is that scenario where ultimately the top of the ladder involves not having to move anywhere else. And it's because you don't need the house anymore. Somebody has died. OK, or it may involve people downsizing. Right. But they are downsizing from a more expensive property to a smaller property. And so they might lose out a bit because of the percentage wise gains and everything like that. But they are likely to be the people who have made the largest possible property gains over the years. Or it might be investors, buy-to-let investors, second homeowners and things like that. But the people at the very top of the property pyramid are the people who tend to have made hundreds of thousands of pounds out of property ownership over the years. If you're in the baby boomer generation and you're living in a £700,000 family home that you've owned for 30 years, and now your children's generation are the ones wanting to move into that £700,000 family home, chances are you probably bought that £700,000 family home for less than £100,000, whereas your children are facing paying £700,000 for it. And yes, you lived through double digit interest rates and all those other things. But actually, once you adjust for the affordability of property, a mortgage rate of about 5 or 6% now is the equivalent of those double digit rates back then. I'm not saying people didn't have it hard. I'm not saying people weren't worried. A lot of people lost their homes. There wasn't the same level of forbearance when payments rocketed, people got repossessed. There were people's and families' lives who were ruined. But if you look at the numbers, the people at the top of the property pile have made a lot of money, and the people who are trying to get onto the property ladder or climb the property ladder are having to borrow sums of money that their parents' generation would never have ever dreamed of borrowing.
Yeah, no, absolutely right, Simon. Let's talk about the conversation with Harry Hill, who set up Rightmove. And he's been saying that he reckons house prices are set to fall by a fifth, by 20%. But you say that the pandemic boom has added, 25%? I mean, obviously, it's all dependent on areas, etc. But so it's not actually going to get us back to where we were beforehand?
Well, let's say you roughly end up where you were beforehand. Okay. I mean, you can't put such a precise number on, you know, it's going to be 20%. Oh, it's going to be 25% and so on. But this is a story from the Mail on Sunday, the weekend. He said, my view on the housing market is that it's going down in every direction. Transactions are going to go down. Prices are going to go down. The only question is by how much. Intuitively, it feels like double figures on both, starting now. And he said, if Britain slides into a recession leading to a deterioration in trade and business, we could see 20% price reductions. Then that starts to hurt people a lot. And that's actually the real problem here, is because the people it will hurt is the people who bought recently, the people who bought in the last 2 years, the people who only recently climbed onto the property ladder, the people who had to pay top whack in order to move home. Those are the people who lose out and see their equity wiped out. That's unfortunately the side effect of rapidly falling house prices. And I think that in the scenario we're in, where mortgage rates have gone up by so much, that it is totally realistic that we could see that amount come off. My anecdotal property index, where I watch the Rightmove prices in my area, the newly listed properties at the moment is dominated not by properties newly coming onto the market. It's dominated by properties that were already on the market that have seen their prices cut, because they go into that newly listed list. And the average price cut, I would say, is about 10% on those asking prices. And you'd expect buyers to negotiate on those. They're not going to be paying asking price now. They might be paying asking price minus 5%. But yeah, that really hurts the people who bought recently. But the good news is if you did buy recently, it only hurts you if you need to sell. If you're perfectly happy in your home and you don't need to move and you have no intention of selling, then you can just continue to live there. And it doesn't matter what your home is worth on paper. It only matters what it's worth at the point when you come to move. So what we need is a scenario where we don't end up with a wave of forced sellers who then end up having to sell and either seeing all of their equity wiped out or end up in that terrible situation of negative equity, where not only have they sold their home, but they don't have enough to clear the mortgage. And so they still end up owing money to the bank after they've sold the property.
Could this get messy, Simon? I'm thinking financial crisis messy.
Well, I don't know. I think that what you have to look at is that most people are not as overborrowed as they were when you got to the financial crisis. In the run-up to the financial crisis, in the UK, what our problem was the huge amount of interest-only mortgages that had been dished out by banks and building societies who'd totally given up on checking people had any way of paying them back. So people were extending their borrowing by going interest-only rather than repayment, by 100% mortgages, 120% mortgages, the old Northern Rock thing. There were people who took out those Northern Rock mortgages who've only just managed to get out the hole that they were in. They got really shafted by this, especially when those mortgages were then sold on and ended up stuck on much higher interest rates while everybody else was seeing the ability to remortgage to much cheaper rates. Also, banks and building societies had stretched themselves as far as they could. Their finances weren't so robust. In the position we're in now, you've had much greater affordability checks. You don't have that whole interest only thing. Interest only has become a niche area again. You don't have the boom in small deposit or no deposit lending that we had. Bank and building society finances are much better, but also so are individuals' finances. If you look at the statistics, a lot of that pandemic savings money is still sitting there in savings. People have a bit more of a backup than they did before.
Any final pieces of advice before we move on for buyers, sellers, first-time buyers?
A lot of buyers have sat on their hands since September, waiting to see what's going to happen. Let the dust settle. I think some of them are going to come out in the new year and go, okay, right, mortgage rates have come down. You know, we had average 2 and 5 year fixed rates above 6.5%. You know, you're now talking 5% for the good ones, less than 6% on an average. You're going to see more of those best rates come out. You're going to see it come down. I think mortgage rates are going to settle around the 4.5 to 5% level. People are going to be a bit more confident going, okay, well, what could I realistically borrow on that? That is going to feed through to them being able to pay less for properties. I've got people telling me this all the time, talking to me about it. is going to lead to less people doing things like extensions and stuff like that. Loads of people are just giving up.
They've already done it, haven't they? They've
just given up. They've just given up on doing their extensions because the prices are too expensive. But I'm also now hearing. I've had a number of conversations with people who had borrowed extra money to do extensions, then discovered that the extension was going to be too expensive. And they're now thinking about just giving the money back, paying it back off their mortgage. So I think we're going to see that contraction. I think for buyers, it means that if you wait till the new year, you're going to be able to negotiate in a way that you couldn't a year ago on property prices. You either paid the asking price or you paid over the asking price or you slung your hook. Now, I think, you know, the market has got a lot of heat come out of it and you can start to negotiate on price. For sellers, if you want to sell, be realistic. If the reality is that you're buying another property, negotiate on the property you're buying and be realistic on the price of yours. And for anybody who is struggling, speak to your mortgage lender. Don't bury your head in the sand. Get debt advice if you need it from one of the debt advice charities. Speak to the Citizens Advice Bureau and remember that there is still a lot of pressure on banks and building societies to show what is known as forbearance, i.e. to help people who are struggling out. And there's been a fresh round of discussions on that with the banks and building societies this week.
Fabulous, Simon. Thank you. Right. Well, if there's ever been a year where customer service really matters, this is surely it. With the cost of living squeeze putting huge pressure on our household finances, the last thing you need is the extra stress of being let down by a company you are relying on. Well, if you have suffered terrible customer service this year, it is time to seethe no more in silence. You can, until the 31st of December, cast your vote in Money Mail's annual Wooden Spoon Awards. Here to tell us more, back for a cameo appearance, is the most special of all guests. It is the editor of Money Mail, Mr. Lee Boyce.
Hi, Georgie. Da, 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 da. That was a big build-up.
Did you like it?
It made it sound like you were having a real special guest on, like Andy Peters or George Osborne or someone, you know, someone actually important. Thanks for that.
I like the fact that Andy Peters comes top of your important list. That is amazing.
That's a shout-out to all long-term podcast listeners.
I know.
Andy Peters, isn't it? That was very clever, Boise. Very clever. For those who don't know, we did a special series of a spin-off series of podcasts where we interviewed people, celebrities and kind of other interesting people about how they used money to get themselves to do stuff like round the world adventurers and people like that, and it did feature Andy Peters as a co-host with me. So well done, Boise, very good.
But you're more special than that, Lee. You're more special than that.
You're
not a traitor, whatever Simon says. How is it going, Lee?
It's good, Georgie. I'm obviously missing This Is Money and missing Simon and missing the podcast. And I don't feel like I got to say a proper goodbye to the podcast listeners. And I was quite surprised at just how many people got in touch to say that they were sad to hear that I wasn't going to be on the podcast anymore. So it's been good. It's been a good start, good couple of months, learning lots of different processes and all that kind of stuff that I won't bore you with. But it's been good. Thanks.
Good stuff. Well, I'll get you to say goodbye then at the end properly. You can have a weepy moment. But let's talk about the annual Wooden Spoon Awards. Notable past winners. What's it all about?
Yeah, so the Wooden Spoon Awards has been going on at Money Mail for more than a decade. And basically, the team make a short list of companies that we feel over the course of the year have not provided good customer service. So we're talking about customer service alone here. We're not talking about products and things like that. And what we mean by customer service is long waits on the phone, bank branches shutting, and ways in which customers have basically been shunted onto things like chatbots and all of that kind of thing. And there's been a real kind of mixed number of winners over the year. So last year it was British Gas Home Care, which is the boiler cover for people with British Gas. That won with the most amount of votes last year. We've had the Taxman, HMRC has won it before. BT, TalkTalk, it's a real sort of array of companies. We really pore over who goes onto this list, and we look back at all of, you can imagine the deluge of emails that we get from readers about poor customer service at a number of companies. So this year we whittled the list down to eight. Right. And on that list, we've got energy firms, we've got government departments, we've got a bank, we've got a payment service provider, and we've got telecoms firms. So again, all of those kind of companies have made the list. And we fully believe that they deserve to be on there.
Lee, why does customer service matter so much, especially at this moment, as I've said, and cost of living?
Well, exactly. So, I mean, it's been a real sort of difficult year, hasn't it, for a lot of people. And there's been bills, for example, let's talk about the energy crisis and energy firms, that it's never been more important for accurate billing. It's never been more important for a customer to be able to pick up the phone and speak to a real human to sort of, you know, try and get issues resolved. But what we're hearing on the ground, you know, if you're waiting for up to an hour to get hold of someone on the phone, that's an incredibly infuriating experience. And it's not just that. You get passed from pillar to post. You pick up the phone, you go through about 18 different options to find who is the department that you're looking for. You listen to that whole music and it keep telling you to go onto the online chatbot, and you might go onto the online chatbot and it's absolutely no help whatsoever. You know, it does absolutely doesn't solve the particular issue that you have. And it's not just energy supplies, but, you know, government departments as well. You know, if you're trying to phone the tax man, if you're trying to phone the DWP, you don't expect to be left on hold for ages. And basically, there's that kind of feeling that you get hold of someone and then you never get hold of the same person again. And you end up, they have to go through all the notes, make more notes. And it's just vital that, that you can get through to someone, sort your query, complaint with minimal fuss. It's not too much to ask. And that's actually why MoneyMail has the pick up or pay up campaign, which is a kind of piece of legislation we're looking to get through to ensure that companies pick up the phone within 10 minutes.
What a dream that would be, Lee.
Well,
a dream.
Yeah. But it's not too much to ask, I don't think.
Well, you say that, look, Lee, again, my unscientific anecdotal evidence, right? I've moved home a lot in my time, rental. And I have to say this experience this time has been the worst of my entire moving career. There has been a problem with every bill, department, council tax, everything I've had, Sky TV, British Gas, everything I've had to deal with. Customer service has been abysmal, slow. I mean, I was on the phone every day for 6 days to Sky for an hour. They promised to call me back on 3 occasions and never did. And it takes one pretty tenacious person at the end and yourself to actually get anything done. British Gas, don't even get me started on British Gas. I have spent over 20 hours on the phone to British Gas since January. Finally got it sorted. I think I've managed to get them to give a big donation to charity, to an energy charity. But Lee, tell me, am I making this up, or has things got a lot worse? Is it the pandemic? Is it working from home? Is it cutbacks? Are they moving everything online? Why is it such a headache?
Well, this is definitely what we're hearing. You know, I'm hearing this around the office from colleagues. I'm hearing this from, readers. And it seems to be that there is almost a bit of a pandemic hangover, I would suggest, of, you know, there's still companies, there's still departments in which working from home is happening. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that working from home is a bad thing. I'm not going to get into that argument. But you do wonder about all the call flows and how it's all managed. And whether, you know, that is an issue. And I think there is this big push to move people online. And unfortunately, a lot of people aren't comfortable going online to do this stuff. And actually, even when you
are rubbish, you don't do anything.
Well, that's it. And it's one of those kind of modern inventions, the sort of AI chatbot, that sort of you put in your query and then it will like spit out a guide or something, and it won't answer your specific query. Because quite often when you do pick up the phone to complain or you have a question, it's something that you've tried to get the answer for and you can't find the answer for. So you want a real life human at the company to tell you what on earth's going on.
Simon Lambert, have you noticed something similar? Has everything got just a lot worse, or am I just miserable and getting old and everything was better in my day?
I have noticed that every time you ever phone any company after you've managed to track down their phone number, which is becoming increasingly difficult nowadays, because as Lee says, they do want you to use their chatbot. And those chat services work great when there's a real person on the other end. They don't work so great when basically it's a glorified way of showing you how to use a website. I can use a website, thank you very much. I don't need a chatbot to help me do that. the recorded message that says, we're experiencing a high volume of an exceptionally high volume of calls right now. Please bear with us. It may take longer to answer your call. It's like you're permanently experiencing an exceptionally high volume of calls.
Lies.
You've been experiencing an exceptionally high volume of calls for 3 years. You were experiencing this before the pandemic. This is just the volume of calls. This is not exceptionally high. It's like when companies repeatedly write off money as exceptional items in their annual results. It's like there's a point where it stops becoming exceptional items and you're just writing down bad investments that you've made. Okay. So stop doing that for a start, you know, these companies. And has it got better? Has it got worse? I don't know. There's companies that you deal with that are just consistently better with it. And there's companies that you deal with that are just consistently worse. I do think, actually, though, controversial statement here. I think when you get through to people at quite a lot of the banks, building societies, even the energy companies and stuff like that, people that I've had a reason to call, I think that when you get through to them, they're actually better and better informed and often more able to do stuff than they were 3 years ago. I actually think that if you can get through to them, it can be better. I do think that there will always be organizations that are suffering from an absolute wave of problems. And at the moment, you know, some of those are on this wooden spoon list, and they're on the wooden spoon list for a reason. Sometimes it's because companies offer some kind of great deal and they get overwhelmed. Sometimes it's because I mean, the DWP, we were talking about this with Steve on the podcast last week, are suffering at the moment with pension credit claims because they managed to successfully have a campaign to get people to claim pension credit and then got overwhelmed. And Moneymail had a great story about that this week. But the problem is there's a load of poor pensioners who were told, go get your pension credit, get the money you're owed, who are now suffering in the cost of living crisis and with the temperature having gone down and sitting there worried about turning their heating on, trying to get their extra money. And, you know, I don't blame the poor people who are answering the phone here and bear the brunt of the population who were annoyed at having had to try to be forced to use a chatbot, then told about an exceptional level of call items, and then waited on the phone for 45 minutes to get through to a person and are understandably annoyed. I blame the people who were in charge.
I 100% agree with you, Simon. 100% agree with you. The problems I had, for example, with Sky was quite simply computer says no, no one could understand it. They had to talk to the manager, but I was kept very well informed. Okay, nobody called me back, but, you know, maybe that's a process thing. British Gas as well. You know, once you actually got onto a person, it's just because the two departments of British Gas Business and British Gas Retail just do not talk to each other. And again, it was an administration area that just kept going on. Shout out to Jessica at British Gas, finally, after 20 hours on the phone to lots of other people. I did have to, at one stage, because this was actually getting really upsetting, I had had debt collectors on the phone for me just for a British Gas error, which then got up to thousands of pounds of allegedly what I owed them, right? As I said, I got a big apology. Everything was wiped off. They've contacted Experian. But it took me to say to Jessica on the phone, this is impacting my mental health. Would you do something about it? And an hour and a half later, it was finally fixed. Lee, which company wins your personal wooden spoon this year?
Before I go into that, I should also point out that a lot of call center staff are very well trained. They're very polite. And most issues actually occur where there's not enough staff. And, you know, or properly trained staff. So, you know, I'm not going to sit here and absolutely lampoon every single person that works in the call center, because they work very hard and it's a very difficult job and you have to deal with testy customers all day. In terms of who wins my personal wooden spoon award this year, I'm afraid I'm going to have to sit firmly on the fence, Georgie. I can't be, I've got to say it's entirely neutral. I don't want to be possibly swaying the vote for anyone. But what I will say is that let's end this on a positive note. There are lots of examples of good customer service out there. From, you know, I talk about my local coffee shop. The guy's so friendly, so happy, always wants to have a little chat. And there's places to get a cheaper flat white, but I go back to him all the time because he's so friendly and nice. Yep. I've recently on the phone to my bank. They helped me reset my internet app. banking because I switched phone. It was done. It was painless. It was done within minutes. Very friendly, very helpful. And a few weeks ago, stayed at a hotel with my wife and daughter. We got to the desk. And the guy said, do you know what? I'm going to upgrade you. Really polite. We had a really polite chat back and forth. He said, do you know what? I'm going to upgrade you to a bigger room because it's simply not sold and it seems a shame for it to go to waste. I'm more likely to now go back to that hotel again just because of how friendly and how polite that person was. And I always want to hear those examples of good customer service as well.
But these are the Wooden Spoon Awards though, Lee. But yes, positive customer service is a great thing and it's to highlight bad customer service. So hopefully it can be good. Simon Lambert, do you have a winner for this year, your personal one? Doesn't matter if you sway these votes, you're not the editor of Money Mail, it's okay.
Well, I don't have a winner on this list.
Oh,
so I'm in the fortunate position where I have not had to directly deal with any of these companies this year or organisations. If I was going to pick someone off this list for the, just for the sheer should have seen it coming, what on earth were you playing at?
Right.
It would have to be John Lewis. With its credit card supplier switch that managed to upset a huge amount of its customers, the most loyal customers who had John Lewis credit cards. If they'd literally just Googled Barclaycard credit limits cut, they'd have seen what was going to happen and they could have avoided it. So I do think that was an avoidable situation. But I'd like to give a special nomination to two companies that I think have really excelled themselves this year, EasyJet and BA. I'm surprised they aren't on the list, but then I just think that maybe people's expectations are so low. The widespread cancellation of flights that EasyJet and BA and other airlines imposed, but EasyJet and BA were the kings of this. And then the absolute muddle they made of giving people their money back is astonishing. Some of the stories that we have heard come in, some of the stories that I have heard personally from people are unbelievable. On the whole, turn up to the airport, your flight's just cancelled, and then just not helping people out. I will give you a personal story on this. When we turned up to fly back with EasyJet from Zurich at the start of the year, which was a portent of things to come, and there was a massive queue and there was two people on the check-in desk, where quite a lot of people check in luggage on the way back from Zurich to London on a Sunday night, because there's loads of people who are coming back from going skiing or snowboarding. So it makes it even slower. And then one of the people on the check-in desk stood up, put their coat on and walked off. And there was one poor lady left who I think deserves the Customer Service Hero of the Year award, who had to process an entire queue of about three flights, all of which were massively delayed due to the fact that the people just couldn't be able to check in. That was a portent of what was to come with the airlines. But BA, I think, my personal story from BA, it takes the biscuit. My sister found out that her BA flight back from Nice in summer was cancelled from the taxi driver on the way to the airport, who said, where are you flying to? And she was with friends. And they said, oh, Heathrow. He went, I'm really sorry, your flight's been cancelled. And she said, no, I don't think it has. He said, yeah, it's been cancelled. And they said, well, BA hasn't said anything. They haven't notified us. So I don't think you're right. And he said, no, I'm really sorry, girls, but I know your flight has been cancelled. Nobody from BA at the airport, couldn't get through to BA on the phone, couldn't get any information, weren't put on a replacement flight. In the end, had to buy EasyJet flights to come home that evening, which they're well within their rights to do so. Even if BA had offered them an alternative flight, they could do it. But on the basis that BA had just gone totally incommunicado and hadn't offered them anything, they're definitely in their rights to do it. 6 months later, they're still trying to get the money back from BA for the flights.
Oh my goodness.
What are these airlines playing at?
Oh, my goodness. So this has encouraged me to go onto the website, Lee, and to cast my vote. First name, Georgie, last name, Frost. Why did you choose this company? I've just written, don't get me started. Listen to the latest This Is Money podcast. Lee, how can people vote?
The easiest way is to go to thisismoney.co.uk/spoon. You'll see the form on there. Just fill it out and send it in.
Lee, thank you so much. I hope this is not a one-off and you'll be back.
Oh, I hope so. It would be an honour to come back on from time to time, Georgie, because as I say, I miss doing it. And don't get me emotional.
We'll say goodbye. Now is your time, Lee. I mean, you will be back, obviously, because...
You know. goodbye, all lovely listeners.
We get
listeners.
Desperate and we need to fill some slots and whatnot.
Oh, I'm not going to say proper goodbye. I'm sure I'll talk again on this podcast in the coming months.
I think at moments like that, Lee, you're meant to say, it's not goodbye, it's au revoir.
Don't make me speak French, Simon. I flunked it in school.
Mange two.
On that note, Lee boys, thank you very much. We'll have you back with the results, I'm sure, no doubt. All right, that's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North from eToro for our weekly look at what's been going on the markets. Sam, how's the past week been?
Well, it was always going to be the calm before the storm, but there were still some decent moves and headlines in the markets this week. Oil has now given away its gains for the years, which is quite remarkable. American equities had 5 down days in a row, which started last week. That only stopped with how we traded yesterday on Thursday. The Bank of Canada were maybe a little bit more dovish than expected, which hopefully will be a precursor for the Fed next week. But there was a rumor/whisper that the terminal rate would be over 5% next year. So that, added with a strong US service PMI data point, really helped send markets lower in what was always going to be a pretty quiet week, though. So there wasn't much news to drive markets. We've been on a good run and we're just having a little bit of a pullback. So if, as an investor, I'm not overly bothered with this week because next week is just so important.
And what do we have coming up next week? Other than obviously potentially the start of the Santa rally.
Yes, well, that's it. Yeah, other than that, and then hopefully England in a semi-final on the Wednesday, we do have some absolutely fascinating market events. Number one is going to be the Federal Reserve rate decision on Wednesday. And to be honest, that could easily shape markets for the rest of the month and beyond. Number two on my list will be the US inflation number, which comes out a day earlier on Tuesday. And then joint third place, I'm going for the Bank of England and European Central Bank rate decisions, which take place on Thursday. So investors will be hoping to get more insight into a slowdown in rate hikes, which could in turn bring forward expectations that next year at some point, interest rates may actually start to go lower again. So yeah, look, we you know, the focus is going to be on that. We do have some other areas to keep an eye on: UK GDP, inflation, unemployment rate all next week as well, and US retail sales. But yeah, busy one. I think everyone is looking forward to it in the markets, but yeah, it's going to be an exciting week and hopefully wrapped off with England in the final of the World Cup.
Well, let's hope when we have this conversation in a week's time, we've got some good news to share.
Yes, absolutely.
Great. Thanks, Sam.
Thanks, Simon.
Welcome back. Now, they may not have the same name recognition as the big high street banks, but savers looking for the best rates may want to give small local building societies a second look. They currently have some of the highest paying accounts on the market. Most notably, Buckinghamshire Building Society is offering the Best Buy Easy Access rate of 2.9% on balances up to £500,000. But as always, there's small print to watch out for. But Simon, firstly, are we saving with building societies or is it just the smaller providers that we're keeping away from?
We are saving with building societies. And in fact, building societies have seen an absolute rush into their accounts over the last few months because savings rates look tempting and attractive again. You're actually losing more money compared to inflation than you were when savings rates were on the floor. But there's something that little bit more attractive about a savings rate promising to pay you 4.5% than there is one promising to pay you 1.5%. On an easy access account, how tempted were you by the Best Buy at 0.5%? Versus the Best Buy at 2.9%. A lot more tempted by the 2.9% one, even though you're losing more money in real terms. But, you know, the good news is, as we talked about last week, inflation is forecast to drop away. So maybe if you fix for 2 years, you might beat inflation now. But the point is, building societies are seeing quite a lot of demand. And the smaller ones are quite interesting.
Tell us more. What do they offer that others don't?
I like a small building society.
Reason or?
I just think it's a wonderfully British thing. You've got your little local building societies. Some of them have local names, but are actually quite big. But you've got your smaller ones. You know, they grew out of the business of offering savers locally a place to put their money and lending money to local businesses and local people who wanted a mortgage. And then they sort of got dwarfed by the explosion of the mortgage industry, the deregulation that led to banks being able to offer mortgages, because once upon a time it was only building societies. And they sort of slipped into the background, but they're still there, plugging away, serving the local community. Often you might find they don't offer the best rates, and that's why people tend to go for the bigger ones. But also what you'll find is that they don't offer current accounts. And because they don't offer current accounts, inertia means a lot of people just put their savings with their bank or the building society that offers their current account. But it's worth seeking out your local building society, if only to support that local organisation, and also because it might have a cheeky little best buy rate, like Buckinghamshire Building Society, which has the best buy easy access rate of 2.9% on balances up to £500,000, which our savings guru Ed Magnus flagged this week. He also flagged that there is one major catch to this easy access account. It only allows one withdrawal per calendar year.
Not sort of trade description sort of thing going on there. Like, I mean, it's not really easy access in my mind.
Well, it's easy access if you want to take all the money out or only want to take money out once a year. Other than that, it's not easy. No. So, it's not really easy access, I suppose, but it's easy access with a catch. And there's quite a few easy access accounts with catches. Some of them only allow three withdrawals and then you see your rate drop. But with this one, a second withdrawal within a calendar year will result in the automatic closure of the account. But it's still a good rate. And actually, for many people, they'll put money in and they'll never take it out. But you can also get some good notice accounts and some other kind of good deals. So Marsden Building Society has a 180-day notice deal paying 3.85%. So that's going to leave you waiting quite a long time for your money. But say you've got some money that you've got set aside because you're doing an extension. So you're one of those people still doing the extension. Well, and you know that you're going to need to pay that builder at a certain point, put your money in the notice account, earns a higher rate than it would do in an easy access account, plan ahead, get out on that day. And it's got a 120-day cash ISA notice deal paying 3.4%. Catch, savers will need to visit a branch to open the accounts. Hinckley and Rugby Building Society has a 120-day notice account paying 3.2%, can only be opened and managed in branch or via the post. Maybe add another 120 days on for the post at the moment. Mansfield Building Society is offering a 3% on its 90-day notice account, but that's only available online. Easier. Has 180-day cash ISA notice still paying 3%, only opened and managed in branch or through the post. And Stafford Railway Building Society, one of my favourite named building societies there, Stafford Railway, is paying 3.5% on its 120-day notice account, 3% on its 90-day account. The account cannot be managed online. And with some of these small building societies, you even used to find catches whereby you could only open account if you lived in the local area.
So there you go. Worth a look. Finally, classic cars. They can be a sound investment, buy the right one, and you could reap the reward of stronger long-term gains than you would collecting art, say, or property and jewellery. But gains are far from guaranteed and sentiment counts for a lot. So how do you know which motors are packed with potential to rise in value in the coming years? Simon, firstly, tell us about the bull market report.
Okay, so the bull market report is a report that Haggerty, which is a classic car insurance specialist, does each year. And it picks 10 cars that it says are ripe for a rise in prices over the next year. What makes a car ripe for a rise in prices? Well, it's that bit, as you just said, where sentiment meets rareness and desirability. You know, it somehow enters the zeitgeist, something like that. At one point, you know, for example, you could buy an E-Type for almost nothing. They were dirt cheap, and then all of a sudden everybody wanted an E-Type, and an E-Type was the thing to have. There are people out there who bought classic cars because they love them and they want to drive them, and they had them sitting in the garage and they drove them every year, and they spent years and years and years not going up in value, and then all of a sudden they shot up in value. And there are classic cars out there that were at one time were very, very popular and have actually gone down in value. They're not as expensive as they once were because people have moved on to cars that they want more. And what you've got to look out for is cars from the youth of the generation that is now in the position to buy themselves a classic car at a price that they can afford to pay. So, for example, we've seen a big boom in fast forwards in recent years. So, you know, fast Escorts, fast Sierras, fast Fiestas, that kind of thing. Even fast forward Focuses, which are much more modern day cars. The 205 Peugeot 205 GTI, right? Just it hit the point where they had dropped loads in value. They became a cheap car. They started to go back up again. And then all of a sudden, that generation of people in their 40s largely now, who always wanted one when they were younger or had one when they were younger, suddenly went, oh, I'm going to buy myself one of those. And suddenly people started buying them. And you see this time and again with this kind of thing. So on this list, for example, we've got some cars that you would think, okay, that's a pretty desirable classic. And people are going to want those, like a Lamborghini Diablo, but you're going to need very deep pockets to buy one of those. We've got Triumph Spitfire, very popular 60s convertible, something that's actually still remarkably affordable because there were so many of them that were made, and they're not hugely, hugely desirable, but Haggerty has tipped them to go up in value. And then you've got the first generation Audi TT. That's a car that many people will still think of as modern, but actually we're now talking about, you know, 20-year-old cars, and people are looking at them going, that's a design classic. I want to get one of those. But then you've also got some more offbeat stuff. The original Ford Fiesta, well, is that offbeat? It was a hugely popular car. There's just not many of them around anymore. If you've got one in good condition, hardly anyone will see them. Take it to a car show. Everybody will come over and talk to you. And they're 40-year-old cars now, and they're going up in value. And then you've got probably the most offbeat car on the list, the Citroën BX. 1980s to early 90s, 60s. Very stylish, very angular. Very rare nowadays, although they were once quite popular, and designed by Marcello Gandini, very famous Italian car designer. And I spoke to John Mayhead of Haggerty to find out why those cars that I've just mentioned are on the list and how they compile it and work out which ones they think will go up in value. John, Haggerty's bull list. It's the 10 classic cars that you think are going to go up in value over the next year. How do you come up with this list?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, really. The bull market is something that we sit down. Obviously, we think that quite a few different cars will probably go up in value over the next year, given the state of the market at the moment. But these are the ones that we just feel as enthusiasts that we would really like to drive. This isn't about investment. This isn't about making money. This is about these cars could go up in value. And therefore, if you're thinking about buying one of these, now is a great time to do that.
And are there some important factors that come into play for a car at a moment in time? Does it need to be that car was pretty popular around about the era that the people who are now able to actually go and buy one can buy one, for example?
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of that. So we look at, so Haggerty worldwide, we insure 2 million classic cars. We have data from all sorts of different things. We do auctions, dealers, we look at shipping data and all sorts of things. And so what we do is we try and sort of spot in the data where these cars are either increasing in value, you know, things like auctions. So we look at the sell-through rates of auctions. So how many of these are actually selling at auction, whether they're selling over the estimated values, whether there is a trigger sale. You know, this is one car which is sold really well, and it might be usually extremely low mileage, something like that, but it's kind of sets the ball rolling. And as you say, you know, at the moment, we're looking at Gen Xers. You know, I'm a Gen X, well, they're called Generation X, born sort of mid 60s to about 80, and reaching peak earning potential. And looking back now at all those cars, which were either poster cars, or they were cars that maybe your really rich mate had, or you just aspired to have because it was a really cool car on the road. And so it is all those triggers. There are millions. I mean, we kind of get into the kind of sociology of the whole thing as much as the data analysis, whereas, you know, it can be something like it can be the big sell. It can be social media bringing it back in. You know, this year we've seen loads of those sort of 80s, 90s supercars just all over social media. And it's really just created this really interesting kind of generation of interest and desire for these cars again. And that is reflected in the values.
you covered off the idea of something like the Lamborghini Diablo that's made the list there. I mean, it is a poster car. It's a supercar, right?
Absolutely.
What about the ones that some people might look at the list and go, I mean, that's just a dad car or a mum car? The Citroën BX, the Ford Fiesta.
Absolutely. So what we try and do is we try and have a really good spread. So the BX, I think we've only tracked a half a dozen or so of these at auction this year in the UK. We've obviously got insured values. They're a couple of grand, absolute minters. Whereas you go right up to the Diablo and obviously if you're looking at the limited edition ones, you're looking at a couple of hundred and more thousand pounds. What we try and do is we're trying to get all sorts of different cars that will be of interest to all sorts of different enthusiasts. So things like the, those cars that are on our driveway, Haggerty, every year we do our big thing we're known for other than insurance is the Festival of the Unexceptional. So it's a celebration of those cars that used to be on driveways, because those are the cars that, you and I and probably everybody listening will have an emotional connection to. You know, I don't know what it's like to do the school run in a Diablo. I wasn't quite that lucky, but I do know what it was like. I didn't have a Fiesta, but I had a Cortina and a Sierra after that, and my parents did. And it's those sort of cars that bring you back, and you know what they smell like, and you know what they feel like. And so those are really cool cars. And interestingly, the amount of people we've spoken to about this list so far, and the BX and indeed the Saab, just jump out as being really interesting cars. And those are the ones what people want to talk about. And that's the whole point of this.
So which one would you have off the list?
Oh, dear. You see, the Saab, I think, is a superb car. So for those that haven't seen, we got Saab 99 Turbo, and it's just got all that history to it. You know, it's got the sort of rally links, it's got a fantastic engine, and it looks absolutely amazing. There are some other cracking cars on the list. We put a Series 2 Lotus Elise in there. I think that loads of improvements have been made to the now iconic Series 1, and there's loads for your money. You know, you can get even the supercharged versions, and later Toyota engine cars are still within that kind of even 20, 30-ish thousand pound bracket. And that is a massive amount of car for the money. We have Bentley Turbo R, which is, just a massive, gorgeous boat for not very much money at all. I mean, you look at the interiors, look at the engine, it's phenomenal. But, the one I would take home, and I think it's because it is my kind of era, I would have to say the Lambo. I couldn't walk past any Lamborghini Diablo, if I ever saw one again, and go, oh, I could have had that. Look at it. Look at the headlamps. Look at the doors. Listen to that engine. We did the photo shoot for this up in Anglesey Circuit in October. And all the guys that were there just said, everything else started up and it was all great. The Diablo started up and everybody stopped and just, listened for it ticking and the fuel going in. And then it just fired up and it's just like, oh my God, the hair goes off the back of your neck. So yeah, I'm sorry, it's kind of the predictable one, but I couldn't let that go.
See, I mean, I do love that Saab and I think it's gorgeous, and it's kind of, it's got that whole story to it. It's, the start of the Saab, the 99 that then went into the 900 and everything like that.
Yeah,
but I can't take my eyes off the BX. I do really love a quirky French car, and I love the BX. But I just don't know how I'd ever be able to explain to someone why I chose a Citroën BX over a Lamborghini Diablo.
To be honest, when you look at the data behind it, you could kind of justify it. So we have had a trigger sale. We've had an extraordinary sale of a BX, which was Art Curiel, a French auction house, sold a Group B homologation BX 4TC for €77,480, which is extraordinary for a BX, but there were only 40 of those. A very special car, one owner from new. These are the sort of things that people go, wow, look at that. Even though that one is extraordinary, look at what is available for not very much money. And at the Festival of the Unexceptional, we've had a few BXs over the years, and they always draw attention. The way they sit is just extraordinary, and you just don't get that with cars these days. It's I get where you're coming from.
John, thank you very much for joining us on the This Is Money podcast.
No problem at all. Yeah, great to speak to you.
Well, that was you there, Simon, talking to John Mayhead from Haggerty. Finally, which one would you pick? Any in there that you're not so sure about would rise in value?
Do you know what? So common sense would tell me that I should take one of the most expensive cars in here. If someone was offering it to me, maybe I should take a Bentley Turbo R. Maybe I should take the Lamborghini Diablo if I really had any sense, because that's the one worth the most money, £106,000 to £229,000. The one that really caught my eye, well, there were two that really caught my eye. Citroen BX. I love a Citroen BX. Yeah. Especially the fast ones. They're such a fantastic design. They are so rare. And I guarantee you take a Citroen BX to a classic car show, you park it next to a Diablo, you'd have as many people coming to talk to you about your Citroen BX as the guy next to you or the woman next to you will
Why,
have talking
Simon?
To you about the Diablo.
It
people just find them interesting.
It's a ridiculous Lego-type car. I mean, something that my parents would have had years ago. Yeah, in the early 80s, there you go.
People love them. And then also the Saab 99 Turbo.
Doesn't look very sturdy either.
I really like the Saab in there. Okay, the Saab 99 Turbo. I think that's an absolute gem of a car.
Right. Okay, just scooching down. I like the Spitfire. That looks quite nice. The Saab, yes, again, that is a hideous looking car, Simon.
Do you know what that's about, Georgie?
What do I know?
It's about classic cars and an interest in them being a slippery slope. And you start off on a kind of mainstream thing like Lamborghinis and Ferraris and stuff like that. And then you just start delving deeper and deeper into it, and then all of a sudden you're lusting over old Saabs and Citroen BXs.
I don't know about that, Simon. Although I do have to say, I rather like this Austin 7 sort of car thing. Anyway, that's it.
I could see you tootling about in an Austin 7.
Coretta de Ville type cars. Anyway, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions of the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate in reader comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.